Da ist er, Teil 2 des Podcasts mit dem wunderbaren Spinotron. Teil 1 konntet ihr bereits vor 2 Wochen hören, falls ihr es noch nicht getan habt, unbedingt nachhören. Es gab viele, viele spannende Insights, auch wenn man vielleicht den Podcast in der ruhigen Minute hören musste, vielleicht 2-3 Mal hören musste, aber dann doch einiges rausziehen konnte. Und ich kann euch versprechen, auch in Teil 2 geht es genauso weiter. Es geht auch so ein bisschen um die Zukunft. Es geht so ein bisschen, wie er seine doch speziellen Karten aufbewahrt. Also viele, viele spannende Themen sind mit dabei. Deswegen wollen wir auch nicht zu lang vorab quatschen. Wir gehen mitten rein in Teil 2. Ganz, ganz viel Spaß dabei.
You've mentioned investing as a buzzword. And right now we are facing pretty strong discussions here in Germany when it comes to investments. And from my point of view, it's completely fair to say that cards could be investments, but some people say out there it's like going to kill the hobby. So what's your philosophy about this one? And can you be both a collector and an investor without losing the passion for collecting?
Yeah, right. So I think the investment part, I think, for the collector who has been in the game for a long time, right, you really see the value kind of accumulates, right? You see the perception to be different. Back then, when you look at certain cards, and now, because they're so pricey and so desired by so many people, you look at them a little differently, right, compared to back then. So there's no desire, like there's no doubt. It's kind of like asset class. But I have to admit, I'm here because I'm a collector, right? I have all those cards. Many of them I still have because I'm a collector. I'm now thinking about selling them when the market goes up a little bit, right?
Yeah.
For example, I can give you an example, like Kobe Prism Gold first year.
Yeah.
I bought the card around 2012, right after it came out, around 1K. And it remains like 1 or 2K for the first, until like 2017, right? And then in 2018, it sold for 4K, which is the 4X, which is great investment, right? For 4K after like 5 or 6 years, right? Back then standard. And then if you wait 2 more years, it's like 200K. And that was like a bad sale because the platform didn't do any promotion, didn't put it into the context. And if you hold it until like 2023, kind of the market bottom a little bit, right? In terms of the perception, some of the prices, maybe the card is not that desirable and maybe even less than 200K, or maybe 200K can be 500K, right? If you sold it like in a better way, but it's less than that. But if you do this year or last year, it could be like 1 mil or more, right? Because they're so like, Prism brand becomes such a big brand. The first year, there's only this as a numbered parallel, right? Everything else is unnumbered. There's no one of one for basketball. So it goes like the price action is crazy, right? From 1K to 4K and then to 200K, 500K, and then
crazy.
Not than 500K. Now it's 1 million. It could be like 5 million, right? As time goes on. So how can you not sell when it's like from 1K to 200K, right? Only when you are a collector and you don't need that money, right? You don't have better way to invest in that money, or you don't really, you understand that you sell certain cards, you couldn't get it back, or there's no other way, you understand it better or has more passion to put money in that it can perform better, right? So that's how I still have most of my cards. So it's basically because I'm a collector, instead of constantly checking, right, how much it is, should I sell it or something, right? So for investment, I think it's still, I think it's completely different, like methodology to collecting, right? Collecting, basically you try to get the best one you can get, right? The collection defining card, right? The card you get, your collection is another level, right? Or the era-defining card, for example, represent the whole era. But those cards, if you want to get it, you have to compete with all the biggest buyers or the most passionate player collectors. And sometimes you have to overpay, right? To a previous owner to overpay like many years down the road in order to have it, right? You are happy about it. But if you need the money, you put it in auction or you don't know how to sell, right? You could sell like cheaper than you get it or not too crazy. But if you like, if your goal is only to grow the money, there are way better way to for that same amount to get a better returns, right? There are certain ways to do that. But the cards you have will not be as impressive or meaningful or satisfactory. And also sometimes to win, you have to keep compounding, right? You keep turning over, keep selling. And when you do that, you have to keep winning, right? If you have one loss, it could kill everything before. So it's not that easy. So my approach is always a collection first, but also be mindful, like when it's too expensive or represent too much value, you have to think about whether how many collector can like basically play at this level, right? How many like similar owners out there, right? That's one factor. And also if you really commit like that, do not use the money that might need tomorrow, right? So you are in a very, cash flow is important. And also always think long term, because even for the best card, even for a few good auctions, it could always have a bad auction for whatever reasons, right? There's, I think, the expectation that you do auction, it would always sell at fair value. That was like impossible. There's so many reasons, right? And then, but if you look beyond that short-term price action, I think the long-term is always the fundamentals, right? Yeah. Why this card is special, and that should play out well, because I believe the IP of the card is strong, and the market cap is huge, and sports is a good IP, right? It's people passionate about it, really like intrinsically desirable. It's not like made up, and the really really nice stuff are kind of, they don't grow astronomically, right? They only slowly grow. The pool of the coffin cards are very small. So as hobby grows, the supply demand will be in balance. I think those cards will be, definitely have investment potential. But for personal, don't stress too much, because one cannot play it perfectly, right? So even you have a nice fund or a good methods or knowledge, you cannot like be too mad about maximize everything. It's impossible. Just to enjoy it, and there are certain opportunities you have to like be surgical, right? Kind of second thinking, and I think it's experience. You have to long term vision, at least 3 to 5 years, and I think it should be good investment. I think but also, I think it's balance, right? It's, you cannot have a bunch of cards you're not enthusiastic about, but they are performing great, right? They give you a huge return, 3 or 5x, but that's not enjoyable, right? You want to enjoy it, but also sometimes when you enjoy it, you might be the biggest buyer throughout the lifetime of the card. So you have to be at peace with that also. Maybe allocate, like we talk about asset management, right? You manage certain cards like growth kind of type, and certain cards like a coffin card type, where it's still possible like some other collector down the road appreciate much better than you, or find a must have, right? So yeah, it's very conceivable that my like, so far at least, good cards or the coffin cards have grown 10x every 7 years. Mm. So that's the data for the last 14 years.
Crazy.
So I think that's an awesome investment, right? I think.
Yeah.
40% per year extra, like gaining. Better than Buffett, better than like anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like completely crazy, but because I'm always trying to convert some of my friends to join me on the sports car train, and they are always like, "Oh no, I'm going to invest in my ETFs, in my stock." And I was like, show me a scalable capital portfolio, and I can show you my card ladder app. And I'm pretty sure that I'm doing better right now than you. But, maybe when it comes to tracking your collection, do you use one specific app, or do you like with an Excel spreadsheet? Like, what's your toolbox to track it?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question, because I think you can be very methodical like that, right? You can be very analytical. I think that's how the world is going, right? In sports, in how you manage information, in the AI, right? How they present stuff. But for me, it's like I kind of like more like organic. It's all in my brain. Sometimes when I see a price, right? Because there are so many social media posts these days talk about this record, this sale, this private sale. And then you just go back and check to basically bring you up to date, right? Like there are certain sales which are like shocking, like staggering, right? Then you try to think about like whether you have the same card and why you didn't get this card back then and so on, right? So that's kind of the thing I have. I don't really have a like real time like spreadsheet or anything, but yeah, my wife always told me like she can help me to build such a thing if I want. Maybe it's not so good also, because that would be very tempting, right? When it's growing like nicely, and maybe there's other investment opportunities. But I think it's always invest in the thing you know, right? You know the cards well. Why would you like cash out your position to do something completely unknown, right? Yeah. You become the retail to their kind of the money grab or the rug, right? So you have to be careful with that, right? Because if you know the thing well, diversification only weakens your position, right? You should like, you can diversify within the industry, within the offering, right? For example, like a little bit blockchain packs, which are very liquid, little bit of like coffin cards, but also growth cards, which grow over time, and cards are of a certain size where buyers are like abundant, but also super high-end card. There are certain buyers who only after very nice card, right? The card without weakness, or the card really make a difference, right? You have to have those cards to have the maximal like returns sometimes. So it's, you have to have a bit of everything sometimes, but yeah, that's my, so I have most in cards definitely.
In hand. Yeah.
But I also have an open mind. I learn things over time also. Yeah.
Crazy. At this high end level, cards authenticity is everything, of course, because we also see sometimes that there are some fake cards around there and some fake signature and whatever. Is there any trading companies that you only trust them, and has there ever been a moment where you almost got burned in the past?
Yeah. So for me, I always, I'm kind of authenticator myself, right? I think I'm the first guy who noticed there are certain 90s fakes out there, right? There was attempt of faking the Jordan Jam Master 3 times. Every time I called them out and did a comparison with the real ones to kind of rule them out, right? And so I have, for example, I really can tell like the 90s era, like which one's real, which one's fake. I think this is probably a little bit too advanced for the newcomers, right? You don't need to be an authenticator to collect. But after a certain point, you really need to at least be aware or at least know like what to look for and on top of stuff, right? So I think that's part of the provenance, part of the journey. Yeah, I think the autograph, especially the in-person autograph, it's very tricky. I think most of them are fake. For the card company, I think the PSA and the BGS are the gold standard, right? I think the PSA have some momentum in terms of the price and the market share, but I think the BGS, for example, in the TCG, in the very high-end sports, still very strong, right, in terms of performance. Yes. So I think both are good. But you need to, like, at least not only look at the label, right, also check the card a little bit. For example, for the auto patch card, even the auto is 10, some auto are manifestly, like, faded and black, right? You should try to find a good copy, like the blue auto. Yeah, and also sometimes the for the auto patch card, a very thick patch with a typical condition sells at a tiny fraction of very boring patch, but like a PSA 10-10, right? Sometimes you find a little bit hard to understand. Yeah, it depends on which kind of collector you are, right? You want the absolutely best perfect condition, or you want the best attributes where the condition is only one of them, right? Mm. I tend to be the second type.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and also the serial number plays a part, as you mentioned, because serial number is more absolute. I think the grading is a little bit overblown in certain sense, right? I think it's important. It adds value and really can multiply the value of the card, right? If it's top grade. But the grading was more sensible, like in the vintage era when things are massively produced. So grade is the only differentiator, right? In the modern era, the things are already rare. For example, out of five, out of one of one, right? I understand top condition will be a bonus to the value. It will enhance the value, but it shouldn't be a value proposition to the card, I think, right? I think it's kind of mixture of rarity and grade rarity. And then the serial number, to me, it's more absolute, right? You only have three special numbers, which brings anything to super rare level. And that special number is especially meaningful when it's the first appearance of an ocean, right? The first serial of first appearance is like the very first appearance. I think there's a value in that that is going to be like gradually recognized in a broader hobby, I think, because it has been recognized elsewhere in other categories. And technical people, like tech people, understand it perfectly, why it's desirable. Yeah. And we have seen some premium of special numbers on very top cards. So it's definitely, and also it's already so like 20 years ago. So it's been there. So it's, I think it's also another, especially I think the first appearance of the first serial and the last serial of last notion, last category. So that those two are very desirable in my opinion. Yeah.
I really got your point, because when it comes to eye appeal, for example, I always prefer a great eye appeal over a higher grade, to be honest, because sometimes I got the feeling that everybody's chasing a PSA 10 or a PSA 8.
Yeah.
And I must say, especially when it comes to vintage baseball cards, I just bought one of the Topps 52 set. A PSA 2, but with an awesome eye appeal, but it was like tagged as marked because there was like a pretty slight point on the back of the card. But I must say I enjoy this card with a perfect centering and a perfect motif much more, and a PSA 2 marked. as an PC5, mm-hmm. to be honest. Mm-hmm. But one point is pretty interesting to me. Like, we are talking about sports cards all the time, but what's about like TCG and Pokemon? Like, mm-hmm. are you into this too, or is this an area where you keep the distance to?
Yeah, I'm fully aware, like, where they are. Like, they are very popular, and the amount of grading is also astronomical, right? Like,
yeah,
the percentage, and also single-handedly save the BGS a little bit. Because the black label is the advantage over the PSA 10.
Yeah.
But I don't have some crazy TCG cards in the collection. Yeah. I know the Gold Star era cards are very popular right now. The prototype, trophy cards, and so on. Those are like fairly rare. But in general, they are like, for example, they mentioned last year they printed like 10 billion cards.
Yeah,
I think crazy. In that amount, there's no serial number, and even the most rare cards are in probably hundreds of thousands range. PSA 10 is already tens of thousands range, so it's not very appealing to me, but
yeah.
I understand there's a fan base. And things are well collected, so it's definitely a category out there, but
yeah.
Probably not for me.
Yeah, it's very interesting because we are in the sports bubble, always talking about low-numbered cards and higher sought-after cards, and then you have a look at the most prominent Pokemon cards right now. It's like this Pikachu McDonald's crossover thing, like with 80,000 submissions to PSA, and we are always like, but where's like the foundation for the value of this card, because it's like so inflated out there with like 80,000 PSA 10 copies. It's like tremendous. Like, there's no real backbone when it comes to value and foundation. But I think what you already mentioned, it's like a huge thing right now. They're blowing up completely. They're running the card shows. They're paying the rent for the organization. Asian company, so I think it's a very fair point, but I must say for me, I only go for the first edition Shadowless set because for me it's like it sticks the highest value in it, or like when the Gold Star area, but everything after this is like just simply mass production to me, to be honest. It's crazy.
Yeah, someone told me I'm still like outsider, but I talked to some expert, right?
Yeah.
But I didn't talk to a bunch of experts, so I took his word for it. This person told me that the Gold Star era, when it was produced, the Pokemon tend to print to the demand curve, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't that popular back then. So they didn't print too much, which becomes the rarity now, right? So that's
exactly
why it's so rare. And now it's so why it's so expensive. But no, it's not because it's popular back then. If it's popular, there will be more copies out there. Yeah. So it's a little strange dynamic, but it's definitely very popular and featured in a lot of shows, like high-end tables and so on.
Yeah,
I think. And also one of the biggest sports card collector called Kimi, he has a crazy kind of pivot into TCG, and his collection is crazy. So he probably understands much better than me and much ahead of time than me. But yeah, but not for me, because so it's, I think I need to do more research, read around for a while before I kind of dive into that. Right.
Yeah.
You told us before before you buy a card, how do you do this research? And you give some examples, because we have some data from the history, like what's happened if they don't win the championship, if they will be a champion. Mm-hmm. How is Spinotron then prepare for this? Is he doing an Excel and combine this together?
Yeah.
Or how do you prepare for this all analytics stuff when you buy a card?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so for example, I think I rely on some research, but I also have a kind of intuition, right? When I look at a card, if I find it's really like a must have, right? Then usually it's not like after research, right? It's like immediate. Then you have to make a decision whether you go after it or not. And then if you really, you have the, for example, you have this allocation of your fund for it, you can afford it for this time, and then you do some research. I think at least I want to know like how many or in which years the similar kind of configuration, right? The type of set of attributes on this card is offered in the past. So I know like how rare it is, right? People focus on rarity only on the given card. You should focus on rarity throughout the entire release catalog. I think that's how you can nail down the true rarity and significance. I also have, obviously you need to know like how much it is, right? It's always tricky because for some good purchase, I think just having the card eventually will pays off, right? I think having it is better than like have like 30% chance of landing it with a perfect valuation at the time of try, right? I think it's that part is also, because when you see a huge sale or huge card getting love, and then you think about you had the chance to have it, why you didn't have it? And yeah, sometimes when you have the card, it's really kind of luck, right? In some sense.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the people, just seller and the buyer, they are just so couldn't close because of a tiny tiny differences. And sometimes when in the bidding and auction, you just wouldn't go extra mile, right? You leave it up to the chance, right? So in the end, whether you have the car to show for it or not, it's not within your control. I think that's not a good approach, right? You really should be very surgical, very steady. I think you, for the pricing, it's always, I think for the very, very nice card, you can always give some premium, right? There's a fair price, but there's a price you are still waiting to get it. I think it's worth it. And also there should be multiple ways to kind of pin down the price. For example, through different players, right? Through different years and through similar cards, right? So I think those, if you can pin down the price through several directions, and it's the same price, it should be fairly confident, right? Yeah. To get it at that price. Something like that. Mm-hmm. So there will be, I think Card Ladder helped a lot, like with the historical data. And maybe sometimes, you need to check the listing and ongoing auctions, right?
Yes.
For example, you buy something which is actually available or listed, and you just trust the historical data. Sometimes there could be something missing. I had experience like that. I think it's the more. I sometimes also talk to people. Like, you should have some people to kind of bounce the idea without risk of have your playbook known to others, right? Because I have seen situation where a guy confiding to another who is a competitor, right, to use his bottom price to yes. kind of to get a card. So that's not good either. So you have your friends who can listen to your logic. They can give you some feedback also. I think that's also important. And also, don't go like over your, because when you do something within control, you know, right? When you do something out of control, a little unsteady, probably you will make like by remorse or something, right? Just be more kind of systematic, long term and yeah, more data driven and and also yeah, but data driven, data based, but not like completely blinded by the comp. Otherwise, if you always want to have a good deal, that would be a kind of antithesis to the card as an investment, right? Because everything will just go down, which is not the case. So you have to be willing to overpay for certain special cards because
yes,
I think that's why it's special, right? People are willing to go beyond to just land it. I think that competition, that bidding war, is part of the specialness of the card, right? Makes you more like emotionally attached and right. I think it's hard. I think you have to experience it yourself, right? Those I think everything I say is out of experience and with a lot of examples behind, but on the surface you listen to it, it's kind of very abstract. It's kind of like yeah, it's just a bunch of principles. You have to really try it out, right?
One point what also write me as a note, because you mentioned it at the beginning, I think it was about your collection. You want to build a collection which is the most unique collection. Correct me if I'm if I'm make the mention it wrong. But how did you did you measure it? Is there a point where you can make a thick on that, or how do you compare to the to yourself to that?
Yeah, basically, I think that's basically my kind of identity, right? I don't want cards that other people own, right? There are people who like, everybody has this card, he also wants this card. I'm not that kind of person. I want a card that is important and nobody has ever seen it, or they know about it but never had a chance at it, or it's never surfaced. I want that kind of card. Because I think, just think of like a museum, right? Those museums, they have the artifacts, so the exhibition pieces, those are like truly one of a kind, right? There's, they when they make the claim, like there's only several copies of this, but our copy is the most like, the most well preserved, or the first one, or something. So there's certainly a way, like basically curation. I think why that's important, because in some sense it kind of is kind of a protection, right? It's because if you have like a copy out of like 100 or several hundreds, you are sharing the same thing with a bunch of other people you cannot not control over, right? Kind of as investment is not good, as a unique uniqueness is lost, right? Everyone has the same. So it's just, that's how like I enjoy I think there's a challenge of trying to identify, try to find and try to secure certain really rare pieces. It's I think that's part of the hobby, basically. Discover the piece, find it, and try to get it, because those kind of pieces usually belong to very special collection, right? To get them itself is it's not easy. These days, lots of things are offered on the auction, right? You can win the auction, that's it. But there are certain pieces will never make to the auction. You have to get those also. So it's, I really enjoy like having things people don't have. I think that's what that might not be what hobby is about, but that's a kind of I like to set certain traits which are impossible to complete. Like and I don't mind being somewhere always in the process, right? Because it's impossible to complete, but still always can add to it, right? To improving, to make it close. For example, the essential credential set chase for certain sports, it's impossible because price is so high. everyone is doing it, and there are certain rare like cards already locked down, right? So it's still okay to chase those as a set collector, because you never know, right? Some people will sell, like you should be ready. And yeah, it's because one example is like Yao Ming. I have like 1 year is like the exquisite base out of patch 1 of 1, right? It's basically the most unique exquisite cards of his. I never think I can complete the full everything 7 years. So I sold one early on. But looking back, if I keep collecting, I would have a chance to collect all 7. Just yes. Like takes maybe 15 years. But you think it's impossible, you never try, and you see each of them become available, sometimes at good prices. You could never complete because you didn't start it, right? There are certain earlier pieces you missed out and locked. So yeah, I think chasing the impossible set is also a good part of the hobby. Yeah. I think some people should do that also. Yeah,
amazing. And that's completely right. And because we are slowly running towards the end, got a few questions left. One is like just popped into my mind regarding your point with the Yao Ming card and the auctions. Like, do you receive notifications by the big auction houses that there might be something in the pipeline that is suitable for your collection, or have to do like you the research by your own, like every normal human being is doing it? But or do you got like some shortcuts to Ken?
No,
sending you WhatsApp.
Yeah, I don't think I'm that big yet, right? There's no one doing that. But sometimes, certain auction houses could be good in the sense that they will reach you out. There's a piece you might find interesting.
Okay.
But it's already running. So they want to make sure you have seen it or something. I think that's good for the seller, because that's kind of like the auction house reach out to the potential buyer, right? This make sure you see it. I think that's very good for the seller. But only to that extent, I don't have the knowledge, unless people like the seller contact me, like, I will be selling this next auction or something. Yes.
Okay. And when it comes to discovering new cards and new players, like when you open your secret sauce box, what's like in it right now? Are there any one or two players out there where you are pretty sure that there might be the next blue chips for the hobby? Are there anything in front of your mind?
Yeah. I'm a bit allergic in the football prospecting, because it's kind of all over the place, right?
It's crazy.
A sure win for 1 year becomes a mess this year, but eventually it will probably be good. For example, Jaden Daniels or CJ Stroud, right? Kind of. But because I collect certain sets, I have exposure to other player like a Drake May or something, which become a MVP candidate, right? I think it's sometimes you get exposed to certain player because of the collecting habit or the method, like pairing, set collecting, chasing special cards. Regarding anything which are like, in the early stage of throwing, like superstars, I don't know. Like, I haven't. That's not my focus right now, so I cannot. But let me think real quick. Right. But I think typically I just chase the obvious choice, right? Like every rookie class, I tend to chase the most drawer like player. That's one way. But there's also like, there's certainly the prospecting game. Yeah, you discover a player, you buy them really low, and he pan out in the short term, you get a huge return, right? That's definitely part of the hobby for like a big part. Right. Yeah, I'm not too sure. Like, maybe I like the Paige Buchers, like, well, but she's also like well proven, right? Like,
yeah.
But yeah, let's see. Yeah, I think still, like, when someone who pan out, it doesn't mean you have to sell everything, right? It's could it be a place where you're actually adding, like, for example, Ohtani, like,
yeah,
he keep winning the unanimous MVPs. I think if you keep adding, I think it's a good play, right? Yeah. I think Drake May probably is good to add a little more because he obviously showed he's one of the best in the class. Right. And regarding soccer, yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah, soccer is a little bit risky, right? If you spend on the like a player who can flames out or with one injury, it's, yeah, you have to really. Yamal is like a rare exception, right? Because so many signs point towards him being the special one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm probably not the best person for this, but yeah.
No,
so
that's fine. But
yeah.
But it's pretty interesting because I really love Drake May. And I was pretty stick to him after the last season, like with very good stats and good next gen stats, etc. But I'm an autograph guy, and
oh yeah, he doesn't have much.
Yeah. To be brutally honest, like his signature is so ugly.
Oh okay,
I can't buy it. Like my aesthetical inner person was telling me, like, Alex, don't do it. The signature is ugly, and now I'm pretty upset, to be honest, because it would be a very good play.
Sometimes you just have to. Yeah, I mentioned similar things before, like a sticker auto, right? Sometimes you just have to. Sometimes your personal intuition is good, but sometimes you have to. Sometimes you dislike a player, but he's obviously a good investment. Sometimes you just have to buy a little bit also, right? So, yeah, it's right. And also the young person these days, they just write horrible, like very short, illegible, like they don't have a penmanship, so it's normal. Yeah. Like, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So at the end, we normally have 5 questions to all of our guests. Maybe have some short answer on that. The first question is, Collectors Parallel Universe, imagine collecting didn't exist. What hobby would you have instead than collecting?
So like collecting for me doesn't exist, right? It's not like collecting itself doesn't exist. Okay, probably because I was a researcher, right? Doing kind of pure math and physics, probably will be a researcher, much more concentrated one, probably a famous one, because I think collecting kind of divided my kind of identity into two completely different skill sets.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I think that's, I would also enjoy that for sure, no problem. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is an interesting question. The swap of your life. What would you like to? Who would you like to swap with cards? Real, historical, fictional? Any person? Is there any where you said I want to trade with him, her, whatever?
Oh, okay. Just meet this person and trade some cards, right?
Yes.
Trade cards with him. Okay. Yeah. I think. The cards is kind of like the setup, right? Basically, I just want to meet this person using my hobby. I don't know. Like, because I'm from the math background, like the best mathematician is probably Bernard Riemann from Germany. Probably, meet him and talk a little bit. Maybe the credential, because credential is kind of like the mathematical like manifestation in a cardboard, like try to talk about a little bit of that, some math in it. It's cool.
A bit crazy question. If your collection could talk, what would your collection say about you?
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. I never thought about it. Right. So basically, they should be respected, right? It's part of the kind of like the movement. You have to. Yeah, I think they should think very highly of me because I can appreciate them to the fullest, right?
Yeah.
Not only see all their rarities and significance, but also hold them a long time and also really emotionally attached to them, right? Yeah, I think it's
okay.
They would think I'm a good owner to them. Probably.
That's great.
Honest collector's questions. Is there, you mentioned maybe in some small parts already, what annoys you most about the hobby? Is there something that really annoys you?
Oh, yeah. There are many, but I'm generally a tolerable guy. So I think right now what annoys me is about the loudest, right? The most headline catching, clickbaiting, cringe guys are actually not what the hobby is, the best collector or the best hobbyist, right?
Yeah.
Those, you know what I'm talking about. Like those, like shitting talk. Everyone has their like their version, their two cents to give. But that's not the hobby is about. That's not why hobbies have such a like strong price or strong demand, right? And also, those guys are not like top investor, not top collectors, because I know the top collector who they are, and they are like highly intelligent, very methodical, very dedicated, very pure, right? They are like collecting and of high like character, right? So those, although they kind of representing hobby to the greater layman's view, right? But because of the clicks, because of the traffic, but they don't remotely represent what the hobby finest, right? So that was my kind of annoyance, because it doesn't really, they don't promote hobby in a good way, right? They, because negativity sells, negativity drives traffic, and maybe eventually that traffic can leverage that into some sponsorship or some jobs, some influence or arrogance, right? Some kind of ego, but that's not what hobby is, right? I think people shouldn't think that's the hobby. That's far from the hobby, right? Yeah. So that's one of them, right? There are so many of them. Yeah, but it's,
yeah,
I'm okay. True. I think you shouldn't like those two kind of detract you from enjoying the hobby, right?
Yeah, 100% agree. We got one question from our last guest, because you can also after that can ask a question which we should ask the next guest. But our last guest asked, we should ask you, what? Cool. How do you see yourself in 5 years in the hobby? Is there
any goals? That's cool.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So basically, as you introduced me, right? I'm like a Kobe collector. I would think myself, I have all the significant Kobes, right? The earliest one of ones, some key cards. I don't have everything, but I have a good selection. I'm very happy with my Kobe collection. And I haven't stopped like in the last 5 years in my collecting. I have collected lots of good cards, but I have added maybe two or three big Kobe cards, which are like very small time compared to what I used to have. But recently I have a big Kobe card recently. So it's kind of get back to the name that I'm a Kobe collector, right? So I hopefully within the next 5 years, I still can add a couple of nice Kobes.
Mm-hmm.
Before I really won this 2012 Immaculate Logo Man, right? The first year Logo Man with Kobe logo auto. But that card recently was obtained by another collector, right? So I'm very happy for him. So I have another goal, which is Hobi has 5 exquisite auto patch 1 of 1 instead of 7. And there's one that has inscription on it, MVP, and also have a nice, only a very small window, but there's a logo man sit on the sideways, right? So that can be thought of as the only single person logo man exquisite Kobe, but with the inscription. But that card has never showed since 2008. So maybe I can get that card somehow. So that would be, I could see myself like in the next 5 years, keep doing the same thing, but maybe get a couple of nice Kobes. Yeah, that's, yeah, always as a Kobe collector, I always want to have some nice Kobes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Do you have a question for our next guest? What would you ask?
Oh, okay.
Ask him.
Right. I don't know. Like, yeah, it needs to be a universal question which applies to everybody. Right. So, which part maybe? Which part of the hobby you wish you could do better? Maybe something like that.
That's nice. That's a good question.
Yeah, you improve yourself in a certain way. Yeah,
that's a good question.
Because everyone has some weakness, right? Like, yeah. Or certain shortcoming he knows, but hard to improve somehow. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's completely right.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Cool. Great.
Thank you very much, Spinatron, for your time. It's almost 2 hours now, and
great.
It could be 3 or 4 for me at least. I think for Alex as well. We thank you very much for taking your time, giving a lot of insight. I make a lot of notes with some sentence you said, for example, quality about quantity. And many, many more. And I think if I hear the podcast 2-3 times again, I will write a lot of more sentence by myself. So thank you very much for your time. And we really appreciate
it. Great.
Appreciate that. And so, Alex, maybe you want to ask some words from your side.
It was awesome. 2 hours of talking about the hobby. And I appreciate really your time and your knowledge and your passion putting into the hobby. Enjoyed it a lot. I think we're going to divide it into 2 episodes because it's just too long. It's crazy. So hopefully it was enjoyable for you too.
It's cool. Yeah, we touched on a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't talk too much about the blockchain. I'm ready to talk a little bit, but it's okay.
Yeah, we need to do a blockchain deep dive.
People just follow me, they will see something. Right. I think the key point is that I think right now is a good opportunity. The value proposition is basically very fundamentally sound, very strong kind of IP and very good opportunity because the price is like 1/3 or 1/5 of the physical counterpart, right?
Yes.
But I think eventually it will catch up and flip the other way because it's so rare and it's such a nice ecosystem. It's frictionless. Recently, I have several big transactions. It takes forever and so many moving parts. That shouldn't be the key part of the hobby, right? If you can streamline that, that's impossible. And also, the card company has something to gain from it because they always have 5% royalty for any sales later, right? So they have incentive to keep the rarity, right? Keep the best products, right? That's important. And also, basically, I think also like kind of coffin card type, it's so limited and the demand is going to be ever growing, right? So that kind of situation always make a good investment. So yeah, I think at least someone should, again, as an asset management angle, you should allocate a little bit into it, right? It's part of the hobby and it's going to be prominent in the future, yeah.
When the people want to know more about that, you share a lot about that in your Instagram, Spinatron. I think you have also an X channel,
right.
And you mentioned Discord, right?
Right. Yeah. I have, the Panini Discord. I have my personal Discord, but I'm not sure it's suitable for everyone, but feel free to like join. I can leave the information to you guys. And also, I think I do a lot of X posts these days, like Spinotron PC on X.
We will share everything in the show
notes. Yeah.
We'll put everything in the show notes. People can
follow. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Have a great week and a great evening, great night. Thank you, Spino. Greetings. Ciao, ciao.
Okay. You too. Take care. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.